Public comment, five star for people on the.
Wait, we gotta.
Call the required public comment,
Regular supplemental meeting called to order, regular and supplemental meeting are recessed. Okay, give any public comments, five star for people on the phone. Okay, report on the health and performance of the pension system.
So before Brenda starts, just for the new members and to remind the other trustees that have been here for a while, when the 17 legislation was passed, they added this section, section 3.01J-9, which requires two public meetings annually where we report on the health and the performance of the pension system. It makes sense to do it when we get the actuarial evaluation, so that's the second one. When we do it earlier in the year, there's not a lot to report on, so we just talk about the financial statements and the contributions because we don't really have a funding status update or anything like that. So that's the purpose of this meeting, and we're required to have public comment with it. So you'll see in this meeting, particularly today, we'll have three times for the public to comment. With that, I'll let Brenda start.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm going to start the first quarter financial review with the bridge chart. The bridge chart represents the changes in net position over the period by adjusting for investment, benefit, and operations related transactions during the period to arrive at the ending net position. We began the year with a net position of just over $2 billion. So we're going to start on the left-hand side and move across. Investment-related transactions have increased the net position by $5.126 million, and benefits and operations-related transactions decreased the net position by $20.6 million. The March 31st preliminary net position is $1.998 billion, and that's down $15 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I want to briefly discuss some highlights from the financials. The combined statements of fiduciary net position compares the results from December 31st, 2024, to March 31st, 2025. And the first section is investments. Total investment value at March 31st was $1.921 billion compared to $1.919 billion at December 31st, or an increase of $1.7 million. The increase is primarily related to changes in the public market during the period. As we move down the page and we look at cash and cash equivalents, cash decreased by almost $8.9 million since year-end, and contributing to that decline were benefit payments exceeding contributions. Next, I want to look at the changes in fiduciary net position. The statement of changes in fiduciary net position compare the results from March 31st, 2025 to March 31st, 2024. And the first section is contributions. City and member contributions increased by $6.85 million when compared to last year. City contributions increased by $5.2 million year over year. In 2024, the contributions exceeded the floor and were based on 34.5% of comp pay, plus the additional annual contribution of $13 million. Beginning in October 2024, the city began contributing based on the city plan. The increased contributions primarily relate to increased salaries and staff levels. As we take a look at the member contributions, The member contributions increased by $1.65 million year over year due to increased salaries and staff levels. Regular and supplemental member contributions increased by $1.75 million and were partially offset by a decline in pension buyback of $100,000. Employee headcount has increased by 225 when compared to last year or the prior year levels. As we move down the page and we look at net investment income, net investment income decreased by $78 million year over year due primarily to changes in the public equity market. As we continue to move down the page to benefits paid to members, overall benefits paid to members increased by over $1 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $262,000. The survivor benefits increased by $839,000. These increases were partially offset by declines in disability payments of $95,000 when compared to the same period last year. New service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase of benefits paid to members. Are there any questions about the financials? Okay. I briefly want to mention something related to our budget, our capital budget. As some of you may know, DPFP owns this building. We occupy the first and second floor, and we lease out the third and the fourth floors. We employ Cushman Wakefield to help us manage the building and the services. The building was renovated in 2008, and the HVA systems have not been replaced since the renovation. We've done repairs on them, but we have not replaced them. Last year, we experienced a system failure on the second floor. And at that time, the quotes to replace the system were $150,000 for the second floor, and the lead time was 6 months. The other option was to replace the four compressors, and that could be done within 2 to 3 weeks. So we elected the second option and replaced the compressors, and then said that in the next year's budget, we would set up a capital plan to address HVA systems. So we did set up a capital plan using our initial quoted prices of $150,000 for each floor, $75,000 for the fourth floor, to be replaced over a four-year period. So now we're in 2025. And we go out, we have our building manager go out and get bids, and we're surprised at how much change has occurred in the quotes since we received them less than a year ago. The quotes that we received ranged from a low of $195,000 to a high of $206,000. So a spread between the four quotes was only 5.7%. So we feel like they're all like in the ballpark. It's not one that's way out. The reason for the increases are the price of the equipment and tariff surcharges. So, however, lead time is now estimated only at 13 weeks. It's been cut in half from the time from last year. And vendors are only holding quoted prices for 15 days. So this doesn't require any action. We simply wanted to alert you. We've decided to move forward with the replacement of the equipment on the first floor, and we wanted to alert you to the expected change in the price that we quoted from our capital budget in October.
Brenda, is that only for one floor instead of all three?
Yes. So our plan was to replace the systems on one floor for each year. starting with the first floor, and the 150, which is now basically 200, is for one floor, and it's replacing the entire system.
Sure. And are the systems compatible, obviously, but then the next question is, do we know what the useful life projections are on the other two floors?
Well, all of them were replaced in 2008 when the building was renovated, and since then it's just been repairs that have been done to them. So I think we've had a good long run on the current system. It's a matter of how much risk do we want to take that it goes out in July or August, and then the building is not habitable and for what length of time.
How long are the leases on the other floors?
Third floor is a 10-year lease. They're about 2 years into a 10-year lease. And the fourth floor is a year into a 5-year lease.
And they didn't give you any projections, so usually it's a 20-year life system. And so I'm just curious if they're like, hey, it looks good for another 5 years, or hey, it looks good for another 2 years, or hey, you're lucky you got the flash.
They did not give us any specific, I mean, the building manager manages this. They did not convey that specific information to us. It's just a matter of when it fails and how much risk are we willing to take for it to wait for it to fail.
It's pushing the way to do it, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So call the regional heads, say you want to talk to them, say you want the best guy down here, because there's always the guy you get, and then and so they need to send their good guy down to basically give you money. They should be able to do that. And then also the system that we're taking out of service, if we keep some of the parts and cannibalize. So if there's a guy, and usually, Brenda, there's only one guy in the whole region, you want that guy to show up, and he'll basically go, yeah, the system on the second floor should be dead already. The system on the third floor is going to run for another 7 years, and you can use parts from the one you're decommissioning, keep the second floor running until the end of next year.
Okay. I'll reach out to our manager at Cushman Wakefield to help us.
Don't worry, they do the same thing to us, Brenda. There's Tom, who doesn't know what he's doing, and then there's Steve, who picks a thing with a Swiss Army knife.
Okay, thank you. Any questions about the HVA system? Okay. Thank you.
So the next item I have is just a standard report tracking that you've seen. I've added the last two pay periods in May to this schedule, and you can see that the difference between what the city's paying based on their plan and what the plan that the board adopted, the amount that we believe we should be receiving is about $350,000. That amount has been decreasing slightly as staffing increases and pay increases come into play. Since the beginning of the fiscal year, the contribution difference between our plan and the city's plan is $9.1 million. And so this is no change from what we would expect to see. Are there any questions about this?
Is there any discussion with the city about this? They're not even paying what they're owed, I mean, what they're supposed to be paying. Do they ever address that? Or?
Well, I mean, at this point, the city council adopted their plan, and that's what's in their budget, and they're paying based on their budget. I think the question is going to be, what do they put in next year's budget? I think, and I've asked actually that question, and I don't know the answer that they're going to put in.
Correction.
Our amount or their amount or less. Yeah.
When will they be presenting their budget?
I believe they get the first look of it in August, but they have to approve it. I mean, the fiscal year starts October 1st.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, there's plenty of time to keep chatting. August
12th, I think.
Pardon me?
So there's plenty of time to keep chatting. So there's basically between now and the middle of the initial budget in August, out between final approval and October, or see if we reach some sort of
September 1st.
Right, and I have two calls set up with Mr. Ireland week after next to talk about the negotiations, and we'll ask the question again.
Okay, so we can to adjourn the required public meeting.
One quick question, and this probably speaks more to my ignorance than anything else. Do we have any exhibits that show the number of covered lives that we have in the whole plan? How many work-life benefits do? I see the change analysis, and it may be in here somewhere. I've just missed it over the last couple of sessions, but is there?
We haven't included that on a monthly basis. I can start doing that. That's easy to do. It is in our annual report.
Yep.
There's a lot of statistics. It's approximately 10,000 split pretty evenly between actives and retirees.
I'm not trying to create a lot of work.
It's not a lot of work. We can do that. And so I used to report out, the contribution report used to look a lot different because we would compare what we were getting plus what the floor was. There was a floor that used to be built in. That report was more interesting than this kind of tracking mechanism. And in that report, I would report on how many, what their active hiring numbers were, which I thought was helpful. And I've thought about adding it to the Minister of Action page. I can do that. I can add a little.
I'm just a little slow. This is like watching a baseball game where you know how many runs are scored. Right.
Okay. That's some information. That's not a problem.
Okay, so we had a motion to adjourn the public meeting. Can I get a second?
They're fitting it.
Oh, Tom.
Okay.
Motion seconded to adjourn the public meeting. Our public meeting, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Signify by saying nay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. We'll go to the regular meeting. We'll do a meeting to reconvene. We have a moment of silence. Okay. We approve the minutes from the special board meeting of April 29th. I had a motion to approve the minutes for the board meeting on April 29th.
Make a motion.
Second.
All in favor of approving the board meeting on April 29th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none. We have a motion to approve the minutes for the regular meeting of May 8th.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. Go to item B1. Public comments again. If you want to, on the phone, pass it off with people on the phone.
We don't need to address items 1 and 2 again.
Okay.
You'll see those. We can go to item 3.
So, the election of board chairman, vice chairman, and deputy vice chairman.
So, just so you know, the timing of this item is strange given when a lot of the terms turn over September 1st. This is required that the board elect from chairman, vice chair, deputy vice chair in June of odd number years. That's why we're doing it now, even though it seems like a lot of time. One of those kind of leftover things that I just think didn't get changed with the staff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this can be done individually or as a slate of candidates, however the board wants to handle it. Wants to make a motion for chair, vice chair, deputy vice chair or at the same time.
The other thing to point out is, John, who's on the phone? Is it Matt still?
Matt and Joe.
So that's mine. So just to remind you, for any election to pass, or any motion to pass, it takes six. So it would take six votes versus like 5-4 wouldn't.
Say a couple of things. I think a continuation about Allison Peace representing him as chair is important given the continuity and given the interaction we've already had with the city and the legislature and so forth. So I would encourage consideration of Michael continuing as chair. I would put, if so, deemed, and I've learned never to volunteer, but yeah, I've never listened to that. I'd be willing to come on as vice chair to assist if it's the will of the board.
Be in motion.
Well, I would say that if we have a Tom who doesn't know what he's doing, who's talking about the HVAC system, I think we have a Tom who does know what he's doing on our board who's run a system. And the only thing that I would say, again, it may be my ignorance speaking, is we used to do a TRS, we had a member vice chair, and then we had a institutionally experienced chair. And so the only thing that I would ask for consideration is, and the only reason that I'm suggesting that is Tom won't run a city.
Mm-hmm.
And so given that you've been the executive director of the office, you know.
Well, CIO, not executive director. But yeah.
Close enough. And you've had to deal with politics, you had to deal with the operations, you had to deal with the members, you had to deal with the and quite frankly, what that does do is it takes a little heat off the tag in the sense that a member is a guy who has to explain why things did or didn't go the way your membership would like it to go. And so that's my only issue. You've got an experienced professional, and then you've got a vice chair who basically has one degree of separation if something happens with a member. So, oh my God, Tech, why didn't you do that? And so that would be my only question for consideration. Does anyone be in favor of it?
Yeah, I think I would second that recommendation with the caveat that the two would work together and collaborate. As we, at least in my limited experience on the board years ago, we saw, I think we've also seen, and Kelly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that we have historically, since 2017, we've always had an institutional leader with experience as a board chair, whether it was Bill Quinn and then it was Nick Merrick. Was there anybody else in just those two over the years? And I think that also reflected the governance structure set up in 2017 as well. So I would support that recommendation, and I'm confident that Tag and Tom would collaborate, work well together. So I think that's an appropriate adjustment to the recommendation. I would support that.
What's the sticking point with the flip?
Not a sticking point. I mean, I think that they would collaborate. I do think that
they would collaborate either way. They would collaborate either way, right?
I would hope so. Yeah. I would hope so. But I do think that somebody who is steeped in what we're doing would serve as chair. That's appropriate. I also think David's suggestion about Tag and his posture vis-a-vis the association is an appropriate one. I also think that we have always had a chair who is a mayoral appointee from 2017, which I think properly reflects the governance structure. So for all those reasons, I think that flip would be appropriate. I don't think substantively it should change the way we operate.
And I think it's a big deal to actually have someone who's not a member chair, so that if something goes down and the membership goes, oh my God, why do you protect? Oh my God, why do you pull that off? Oh my God. Thank you. And, you know, I think, look, it wasn't a huge issue with TRS, but there were moments when, you know, Linus Wright was very excited, and then that Disney was very excited to take the vice chair and not the chair. Plus, it's a Thursday. Why not be practicing on Thursday?
What are your thoughts?
Pardon me?
Yeah.
My concern is that I think the mayor and the city, I think there's been concerns about control from the city council. That's their big issue, and I think the mayor has...
I'm sorry, can I speak up?
I'm sorry. Well, we've heard pretty much since October of 2023, when this whole process started, was the city council wants more authority on the board, and they've been fighting for that in a while. So I feel that having either myself or Matt Schomer as the chair kind of protects the board in our fiduciary position to the pension, because we're elected by the members. And so we don't have to rely on city council or mayoral approval to, it won't affect decisions we make. That's my concern. Because we saw previously where we had our chair and our co-chair and our vice chair removed within 6 days, when basically they didn't agree with what the city wanted to do. So that's my concern. So that's why I think either myself or Matt should be the chair, just because we have a, kind of a layer of protection. And yep. and if the concern is that, you know, we have to explain to the members what happens, we have to do that anyways. We have to. I mean, we're held accountable at them anyways. So that's where I come at it. We're not as affected by the whims of the city and the city council and city government. We're directly, we have fiduciaries to the plan and directly to our members in the plan and the retirees and the active members. So that's why I look at it.
Help me with that. When you say they want more of it, they've never asked. It's set up for 6 mayoral appointees and 5 non-mayoral appointees. They've never asked for more than that, or have they? Maybe I missed.
Well, the city council's been very verbose in their concerns that they wanted. That's why, I mean, that was part of the whole reason for 1527 and the whole, they wanted more say over what we're doing. That's why, I mean, that was part of the biggest issue. One of the biggest issues was they wanted to, and the wording was, you know, over the how our investments were made and certain settling lawsuits and all that. They just wanted more authority. You pointed out that they have 6 appointees. And my concern is that judging from history and what happened with the previous chair and vice chair recently, that I think that's not a concern of happening again. We don't have to deal with that kind of chaos if we have a fire or police trustee as the chair.
I agree with that.
Yeah, they have to report to their. It doesn't matter. Whatever we do, there is going to be, like, I have to report to police and fire no matter what. It doesn't, they're not going to just say, oh, because you're the vice chair, you know, or you're the you know, currently I'm deputy vice chair, right? They still want to know. They still hold me accountable. They hold me accountable for everything. We don't make, you know, S&P goes up 3% in a month, 2.9, they want to know why. So that's still.
That's human nature.
Yes. But my point is that I think there's a layer of protection because, as a board, there's a layer of protection in that position and overseeing the board and being a true fiduciary, because I don't have any concerns about what the mayor or city council or anybody politically for the city thinks. My concern is the plan and the members of the plan, which is the plan. So that's why I think it should
be. Actually not. Plan is an entity unto itself. The members are a beneficiary of the plan.
Okay, when I looked, it was fiduciary. It said fiduciary directly to the members and the plan as a whole.
Your fiduciary contributor is a member. But our responsibility is.
And I'm not quite sure. I sort of view it symmetrically too. I mean, I know that the city council people will clamor and they do this, but police and fire do the same thing. They call for meetings. They call for meetings with you and Kelly and others. And so we're always going to have that occurring. I think the question is, what's the appropriate leadership structure given the nature of the governance that was promulgated in 2017? What's the nature of the appropriate governance given what we've done historically and what kind of expertise do you want as the chair? I think those are the relevant questions. We're always going to get, there are various stakeholders, and they're always going to have points of view.
I think there's a disconnect, mainly with the statement, because you guys weren't on the board when this whole thing occurred. It seemed very sort of malicious when they replaced the chair and vice chair. It wasn't like, you know, we're going to hold to the letter of the law. It
Who did they replace?
They removed Nick, and then they removed Tina 6 days later.
Yeah. Who's that? The board acted.
The mayor. The
mayor. Oh, you mean just for a purpose? Well, I thought Nick was, he went off to be an ambassador, you know?
He was a few months. We're going through this chaotic period. We're still negotiating with the city and everything, and then our leader's removed. And then 6 days later.
Isn't that their prerogative, just in the way that the police and fire has a prerogative to remove the other five?
It is their prerogative. What I'm saying is that I think it was done for political reasons and not for the benefit of the
police. What does that mean? Political reasons.
They were upset that we weren't agreeing with their version of the plan, and they were upset they were trying to, I mean, honestly, I think they were trying to undercut our ability to advocate for the plan, for the members.
I mean, you call that political. I mean, that's just a policy matter. They have a policy position. Others have policy positions. That's all perfectly fine. So I just struggle with that. I think that's a misapprehension of the governance structure. I think that's the prerogative of the respective stakeholders.
Well, when were they
September, right?
So were they holdovers?
Yes. Oh, so they weren't on subject to a specific. So they were holdovers.
Somebody reached in and grabbed them and shot them in the head. Basically, they were in holdover and serving basically in a holdover position under state law. And they were.
Yes.
Just like Steve is right now.
let me clarify something for the board. The statute does not allow sort of at will removal of trustees. It has to be. There's only two reasons. One, because you don't attend 65% of the meetings in a year, or B, you're not qualified to be a trustee. Otherwise, you can't just be, like, the mayor can't just remove a trustee, or the police and fire can't just remove a trustee. That they have to serve those.
Unless they're in a holdover status.
Unless they're holdover, then at any time.
And those two were holdovers.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I understand the law, and I understand the process. Look, the other thing I'll put a fine point on is, I did get here, and Marcus, you make a really good point, which is, I don't know what came before, and, you know, I come in with kind of the idea, right? So, if somebody punched me in the face beforehand,
I didn't see it.
I appreciate it. Once you've been punched in the face, you've been punched in the face. But the reality is, I come in and I'm like, look, there's a bar room fire, let's clean up. And with some of the stuff we're going to talk about a little bit later, I don't like being on the war footing. I also don't like punching people while I'm trying to negotiate. I do like the idea, the fine point, of putting a former professional in the chairmanship role as a way of sending a message that what we're trying to do is what is economically and commercially reasonable for the plan. And I think that, and I think having that separation, so yeah. Put a fine point on it. Hey, there's six votes. And so at some point in time, six votes will vote. And Kelly, I think you just said it. Well, six votes will decide. So at a certain point in time, you really want to send a message that we're here to negotiate. We're not here to keep punching. And unless we want to just keep punching. And if you want to keep punching, then the world turns into a punch fest. And I like what one of my partners once said in the partnership buyout. Just because you want to stop punching doesn't mean the other guy stops punching. Once you get into a punch. And so I like the idea of saying we are making economic and commercial decisions here and putting a professional in as a chairman.
They're going to work collaboratively. We're going to get Tom's expertise directly as well. Because I think it sends a message to the people that we're, you know, the working towards or working for, to say, your guy is the chairman.
You file a lawsuit. If you send a message to someone else that says we're trying to figure out how to get the person.
So I think we're doing that by our action.
Well, we'll talk about that a little later.
Okay.
Well, actually, let me rephrase that. It depends. I've got one very important question to ask a little bit later. And depending on what that answer is, I will recant what I just said and apologize. But if the answer is somewhat different, then yeah, I'm going to stand on my stake. Yeah, we're sending messages that I don't appreciate.
There, There's also a current dynamic. TAG and I and Kelly have been interacting with the city, trying to negotiate things. I think the chair should be a little bit removed from that. I think the chair should be a little more disinterested. I think that sets the right signal to all stakeholders that we, in the main, we're going to conduct our business under a trained professional, because the most important thing is that we maximize these assets for the benefit of the plan and its beneficiaries. So I just think that's the best.
That's not how we've done it. I mean, you know, Nick was very involved in all those discussions as chairman.
And I think
that's not how it's been done previously.
And I think that was in some ways disabling.
Well, I mean,
because of where we ended up, we got to find our way out of that.
It's easy to say, you know, we've had a certain policy of the chairman's role, and then we say that chairman has been active, and now we need to do it differently. I mean, it's kind of like talking out of both sides of your mouth.
No, I just think the dynamics are different now, given the nature of the negotiations and where we are and what's left separated. It's something that hasn't occurred. I think it's a change circumstance that requires different optics. So I think it's not correct to say the circumstances are the same.
I don't agree.
Well, you know what I think comes down to is basically equal people differ over what's
reasonable.
So, you know, we can count the votes and see where it falls out. And, you know, it will be the beginning of we'll count the votes. So if we can't reach a consensus on this matter, I understand it's firmly held. You know, let's count the votes and see where it falls. All know that you're on in, you know, when we can't reach consensus, we'll try and reach consensus.
Yeah, but my position is I just want to do what's best for the trust. At the end of the day, we all do. And I would ask Kelly, this is an unfair question, what do you see as resonating more with the negotiations we're going to have ahead of us in terms of
it? I think any of you would be a chair, and I'm want to weigh in on this.
Okay.
But negotiations are just a part of it.
You know what? Yeah. I have to, Tom, I got to, look, you're doing a great job. You got a long career here in front of you. And, you know, if we're going to end up in 6-5 votes, which is where it looks like for Tom, then you don't want to side with 5 and you don't want to side. So, sorry, Tom. I think that's
a little bit unfair, but if we're going to a regime of 6-5 votes, then basically you should have to decide what is best for the fund. And in all fairness, I think everybody sitting around this table is trying to do what they think is best for the fund. We just disagree on the best way. So I respect the loyal opposition, but I understand that it's the loyal opposition.
Yep, fair.
So,
how many votes do we have? And do we have anybody on the phone?
We got to get
Matt and Joe are on the phone. Is that right?
Yes.
That's correct.
So, do we have any motions? Any motion to elect anybody? Chairman, Vice Chairman, Deputy Vice Chairman?
I think point of order, what happens if there is not a 6-person vote in favor of a particular slate? It gets deferred because we're missing a member, aren't we?
So we would try again next month.
There's a new one coming over in September, right?
But we just keep voting until,
is that right?
Yeah. Until the cows come home.
We heard from,
or until we can actually reach consensus.
And also, have we heard from Steve on this issue?
I have not talked. I mean, it's not my place to talk.
No, actually, I just wonder whether I didn't.
Actually, Steve's still stuck in traffic. The tollway was a mess.
Oh. Yeah. Well, can we? May we?
Actually, as a
we defer a month until we have full meeting?
As a matter of order, actually, there's a motion on the floor.
I don't know if it was a motion.
I just wonder if we actually can discuss it.
No, it was more just a comment.
Okay.
Clarification.
I'm sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
No, that's, well, I guess the question is we have, how many people we have?
We have nine.
May we defer until we have the full board until next month? I mean, I don't see what the urgency is.
I think.
I would like to make a motion to elect Michael as chair. This is Matt.
Can you answer my question?
Yeah, so I think the statute said the board shall elect officers, but, you know, I think the overlay is if you can't get six votes, then, you know, so the answer is you could determine that you can hold it over if that's what the board wants to do. So I think, you know, it sounds like there's a good faith effort to try to satisfy the statute, and if you can't satisfy the statute, then you can carry it over to the next month until you can get officers elected.
Well, I would be in favor of that to let people reflect on it a little bit. We have two members who aren't here, and we have one member who's not present at all. So that's just my call on it. It's not like we're gonna get through this.
Yes, so there's a motion that doesn't have a second yet.
Okay. Right, we have a motion to elect Michael Tagnese as chairman, and there's been a second. We need discussion. But all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. I'm sorry.
Any opposed?
Opposed.
Well, okay.
Opposed.
Okay, going to recap.
All right, so all those in favor, signify.
Actually, why don't we just do a voice vote?
Yeah.
Okay, so start with Tag.
Yes.
Michael.
Yes.
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 No.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Joe?
No.
Matt?
Yes.
Six. Okay.
All right. Any motion to elect a vice chairman?
Mike makes right.
I move that we elect Tom as vice chairman.
I'll second.
Motion to elect Tom vice chairman. We have a second. All those in favor say, what do we do individually again?
Yeah.
All right. So. An aye.
Yes. Yes.
David?
No.
No. Yes.
No.
Joe?
No.
Matt?
Yes.
Motion to elect a deputy vice chairman.
Can we just vote on that or no?
Deputy, yeah.
Deputy vice chairman.
Oh.
Any volunteers?
Is it better make a motion than wait until September? Deputy vice chairman?
Oh, heck, you got six votes. Guys, just decide what you want to do.
Yeah.
Can't wait until I have six votes.
Yeah. Again, they could take this bell, but they could if they can't. So,
that's a motion.
And then there's no voter motion. Carry it over.
There's no motion for deputy vice chair. So we move on. Financial audit.
Thank you, Tag.
John and I are both moving in at the same time. Okay, audit update. The initial field work for the audit began on May 19th, and it is continuing today.
We've submitted approximately 81% of the PBC requests to the auditors. All of the confirmations have been sent except for legal and actuary, and those will be sent closer to the end of the audit. The member census data has been submitted to BDO so that they can begin their review before the actuary report is completed. We hope to receive the remaining investment information in the next few weeks. Then we will be able to submit financial information to the actuary. Once the information is submitted to the actuary, then the experience study will be completed, then the actuary report, then the audited financials, and the annual comprehensive report. Staff now is working on the parts of the financial statements and the ACFR that can be completed, and we look forward to those to you in the future. Any questions?
Okay, the next item is the standard approval of the ministerial action. This is the summarizes the activity for June. The thing that is most interesting to me is if you look at retirement for the first 6 months of the year, there's only been 51, which is 25% fewer than the prior year and actually 33% less than 2023. It's a good time actually for us to have lower volume. We have one counselor on the maternity leave now and another one going out in 2 months, and I have two brand new employees in addition to that in the group. So the lull is actually unusual for the first half of the year, but working through training right now. Are there any questions about this report? And I will add additional statistics to this for the next month. Okay. The next item is approval of a de minimis drop payment. So in 2017, and actually, you know, even kind of ongoing, sometimes when we annuitize a drop payment, it becomes a very small amount. A few years ago, we came to the board and said, is there a certain amount of drop payment that you just want to approve that we can pay out in a lump sum rather than over time? The board decided that you wanted me to bring them to you individually. So this is one drop payment that is for an alternate payee, so an ex-spouse of a member has a drop annuity payment of $2.75, and she doesn't have any other ongoing benefits. It is scheduled to be paid out monthly until 10/31/26. It would be in our best interest to pay her out in a lump sum payment rather than we've been reaching out to her to try to set up this $2.75, and she has not been interested, so we're spending a lot of time on this. We think we can get her just let us pay her what ends up being about $850. We'd all be money ahead. So I'm seeking approval from the board.
That sounds like something my ex-wife would have done. No, you got to send me a check every month.
A monthly check.
Yeah. Yeah.
With a stamp for whatever, 77 cents.
Yeah.
We had one couple that the board did approve that the member's drop payment was 25 cents a month, and the spouse was 26 cents a month. Luckily, we got rid of those.
I would demand my motion.
Can I
get a motion to approve the amendment lump sum drop payment?
I move. I'll
second.
I appreciate that very
much. A motion and second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Board approval of trustee education and travel.
Okay, here's a list on this page and the following page of some upcoming training through NCPRS and TexPRS. I didn't know if anybody wanted to add their name to the list and get a board approval or if
good. I think I need to go. I think Matt and probably, or I know Matt's online. There's a, what's the second?
It's right here. Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm going to go, but I've already. Before I cover my expense.
Yeah, the one right before that, I think.
Oh, yes, the bottom, number five. You and Matt need to do the second part of
it. Yeah, the second part of it, yes.
So this, which they'll talk about next, the NCPRS accredited fiduciary program, it's a two-part program that you do both parts and then you have to take a test. So Matt and tag went to the first part, and you want to add your name to go to the second part?
Yes. Sure.
Sure.
Complete the program.
Can we get a motion to approve adding that tag to that?
David, do you want to go to Texas?
Yeah, I think I will, but I'll cover my own expenses. Yeah, I will.
Okay.
In fact, actually, one of my partners is up, so if anybody's interested, in golf on Sunday.
Is there a handicap required, or
do you need a caddy? There's a joke about in a man a hat. You have to be of a certain age, but he was on tour for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
I have a picture of him wearing a man a hat. I think certain guys know that.
Yeah. Okay, so we need a motion to approve man for in Seepers.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Yeah, have it.
Okay.
Following that, reports on meeting seminars and conferences attended. So like we just discussed with you in Seepers, the NAF training. Talked about this earlier. It's interesting training. I think I had previous training at TechSpurs, and a lot of it was kind of redundant. So if you've done training through TechSpurs, I don't know if I'd recommend this going forward unless you want the and obviously this is a two-part thing, so I have to do the second part before I can really. But I did enjoy it. There was a guy from Makita came out, and it was very interesting, some of the things he talked about. So overall, I had a positive experience. You have a level of expertise on the sport. Like I said, it's a nice thing to put next to your name. I don't think everybody who's sitting here probably has a pretty good understanding of most of this program already.
Well, but, Tag, weren't there a lot of other plans from around the state there as well?
Around the country, yes.
Yeah,
the biggest benefit, I think, in all of Seepers is talking to people. I mean, the biggest benefit I got was talking to people outside the classroom about just dealing with their state governments and how they lobbied, and I think that's pretty much almost every conference you go to, but definitely, speaking to people, and the experience I had in Austin and stuff, and Matt and I had, and that was outstanding. I think Seepers does a great job with their conference overall.
And kind of portfolio allocation issues too, because sometimes there are people who are on the leading edge, and you find out, hey, the flavor of the month isn't the flavor of the month.
Yes, and it's, I think
why people make that mistake.
Wyoming is actually into crypto now, so I think they're the first. Yes, that's kind of my reaction too. So it's interesting. It was interesting to hear some opinions on that. So,
yeah. As a police officer, you know, as a house party, you want to be one of the first guys in and one of the first guys to leave. Mm-hmm.
Yep. One of the smartest drug dealers I knew always left the bar early. True story.
Okay, stuff.
So. Smart. He gets in fights at closing time. He left before closing time.
Put it in my pocket.
He had his own business to run.
All right, we'll move on to the portfolio update. I have a few intro comments, and then I'll turn it over to Christina to go through the rest of it. At the bottom of the page, but most importantly, I introduced Luis to most of you guys, and we added a new investment analyst that started on Monday, Luis Solorzano Trejo. So he just graduated from SMU. We're excited to have him on the team. So welcome, Luis. All right, so year to date through end of May, the total portfolio is up 4.5% with the public portion at 5.9% up. That makes up 80% of the assets right now. We had the board approval last month of the direct lending funds with KKR and Golub, so we're working on contracting and funding those with the KKR one coming up at the end of June.
Any issues?
So we don't foresee any issues. They have a closing. We probably have a little bit of leeway, but we plan to get that, wrapped up. I think the funding of that, they have a queue right now, so ideally we come into the fund at the June closing. It's probably Q4 before they start calling any capital. On the multi-asset credit search, we got RFPs back from 11 firms about 2.5 weeks ago. We've been going through those. We have a call with Makita tomorrow to share thoughts, but the idea there is we bring two finalists to the July 24th investment committee meeting to be interviewed and then bring a recommendation back to the board. Us and Makita continue to monitor the portfolio for any rebalancing activity we need to look at. Next slide is looking at investment initiatives.
One quick question.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
On KKR and Golub, who does the legal work for us? Is it part of a pool concept? Because I know we haven't made a lot of private equity investments.
And we haven't done one in 9 years. So
what's kind of the process for us?
So we have a number of firms we work with. For those first two, I've gone to a lawyer we work with in the past at Jackson Walker, but we've used DLA. There's a number of firms. And I expect that we may try different ones. And different ones may be in different areas as well with respect to pure PE versus, this credit, which is evergreen, so it's a little different. So we're going to start mixing it up and trying to find the right balance and the right people in the right slot.
Do you think you ultimately, because regardless of what happens, there's going to be a quant of capital to invest? Is the idea that you think you'll go to a pool at some point and just put them on a rotation?
I don't know. I think we want... myself working with the investment people want to find the right people to do it efficiently but well, and how we work well with. So it's just been a while. So I think we just sort of have to figure out, is it going to be what you suggest, a rotation? Is it going to be use this firm for this type, this firm for this type? Or I think we're just not 100% sure. We're trying to still figure it all out.
Fair enough. Jackson Walker's a great firm for that type of work. So
yeah.
You'll get there, but I think if we get to a process, it's possible. So,
right.
Because I know the sponsors like to know, oh, wow, it's going to be A&E, Jackson Walker, there's a pool, and it speaks to our confidence.
Yeah, I think there's a number of firms like that who have a lot of, they can read an LPA, and they can say, this is a Kirkland, this is a Paul Weiss, this is a Debevoise. They all know sort of each other on that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Thank you, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. So, investment initiatives crossed off a lot in the first two quarters of the year. Focus right now is on the multi-asset credit search. On the private side, we're looking at options on secondary private equity funds, and also we have planned a buyout investment in the rest of 2025. On the private credit side, we've moved to looking at asset-backed lending funds, as well as some opportunistic investments there. We would expect the multi-asset credit funding to occur probably in Q4. And then I wanted to flag a new item here. We plan to do a search probably towards the end of this year, early next year, in global equity on the value side. So potential replacement of a manager there. But we're going to talk to the IAC about that in a few weeks here. Any questions before I hand it over to Christina?
Thanks, Brian. So we want to share a couple of interesting charts. As the economy is experiencing higher for longer interest rates, inflation, and policy uncertainty, so what we are observing is that U.S. consumer is weakening. So this is a busy chart, but if you look at the top left chart, you can see that the top 10% of earner now account for 50% of all consumer spending. This is a trend that has been taking place over the past 20, 30 years. The middle chart shows that the excessive saving that consumers have accumulated during pandemic has for the most part depleted for the bottom 90% of earners, while the top 10% earners have been able to maintain their gains during the pandemic. And then stressed consumers are turning to their 401ks. So in 2024, early withdrawals in 401ks reached 5%, which is the highest level in recent years. And then if you look at the bottom panel, bottom part of the chart, it's you know, the left, bottom left, is the delinquency rate for a credit card. I want to point out the dotted line is the delinquency rate for credit card, not in the top 100 banks. These are the banks that serve riskier credits. So you can see the delinquency rates are accelerating. And then the second chart is the auto loan delinquency rate. And then the last chart is the credit card charge-off rate. So you all know consumption is two-thirds of U.S. GDP. So I think U.S. consumer is showing sign of weakening, which is a little bit concerning.
So is this, I'm sorry. Is the auto loan, is that for high-risk individuals as well, or just overall auto loans?
I think it's just overall auto loans, yeah. And then, so these higher for longer interest rate continues to put pressure on delinquency for commercial real estate loans. You know, the CMBS delinquency are rising across most property types, but regional malls and offices stand out. I mean, we know the story about regional malls. It's been going on for some time, but this blue line is the office. You can see the delinquency rate is for office buildings is accelerating. So next we turn to the equity market. So year to date, as you know, that the international development market have been leading the performance. This is as of closing of Tuesday. International market returned, it's hard to see, 16.22%, while the S&P and S&P 500 and NASDAQ are lagging at 2.67% and 2.09%. You know, for the DPF, public equity performance, it's prelim return that we ran. We are at 9.6% against our benchmark of ACWI at 6.5%. So we're outperforming the benchmark by 3%.
Hey, Ryan, if you take a look at the prior slide, look at the second derivative for multifamily.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a recession, given the rate of change, given what happens in a recession to multifamily, you might want to take a look at any of the sponsors that have a value add or a distress play in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think by the time you get the documentation done,
yeah,
the market will be ripe. And so it's
finished. Yeah, I mean, we have legacy real estate, but to work through, and a little bit of that's in office, but I think it'll be a good opportunity to start deploying some capital in the next couple of years here if this continues. I think credit as well, you know, we have the direct lending funds, but some of those companies they're lending to, if they can't hold up, we need to have something else in that portfolio.
The portfolio allocation issue, yeah. But because I ate a bad piece of beef once doesn't mean I stopped eating steak.
We'll continue to look at it and look at opportunities across the board.
When the definition of multifamily is really changing too, you know, it used to be pure multifamily, and that was going to the point where it could be a combination of entertainment and, you know, restaurants and the like, as well as multifamily all in one space.
Yeah. And I mean, our biggest real estate manager, AEW, will be in, I think, at the September meeting to go over their portfolio, but they've shifted kind of what the developer there is doing from more pure retail or pure, you know, office to the mixed use concept.
Sorry,
nothing good.
Yeah, I think he's got a good point, though.
Yeah.
I think you're saying the same thing, which is, you know, in spite of our history, we have capital, and we're looking to redeploy capital, and we can be really optimistic, right, with things that present themselves.
Yep.
And so maybe it's something else just to think about, focus on in the near term as we build out.
Yeah, and what we try to do in the credit portfolio is take care of the private credit beta with the direct lending and then try to be a bit more opportunistic with the rest of the commitments. I think the same thing kind of holds in private equity with getting the secondary exposure and then looking, talking to Allborn about what areas they like, what areas we like. So that's those commitments, and that applies to real estate as well.
And it's just, Ryan, I'm speaking my own book.
Yeah.
And I know in the space we're in, what we're seeing, and we're experiencing some of it, which is there's tremendous value 4 years out,
mm-hmm.
but we're not certain we can actually carry something for 4 years. And so therefore, if you've got longer duration capital, there's some really choice opportunities that are starting to shape up, I think are going to continue to shape up as, you know, investors get exhausted.
So I
hear what you're saying. I'm just saying, you know, there may be steak on the grill, and, you know, perhaps we have to take a really hard look because of some of our prior allocations as to what meets our threshold.
Mm.
But I think there may be some tasty meals out there.
Yeah,
good point. Just a little more perspective. Right now, there's a lot of redemption funds that are in the marketplace, thanks to the past cycle. And it might not hurt to look at the secondary markets.
That's another consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Allborn likes secondaries across the board, not just in private equity, given some of the dynamics and lack of distributions coming back on the private side.
And that's what we did at Children's, and we had some phenomenal success. And the bite sizes are good for us, too.
Yeah. Were they buying directs, or were they going through funds?
Well, so they've got a little more bench strength than you guys have. The quality is the same. It's just they have more manpower. And so they end up going direct, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
So you eliminate that load from the secondary fund.
Yeah.
And be creative. I think you've got support to be thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
But to be creative, to try and get a little extra yield.
No, I think we got the right system set up with IAC and the subcommittee to work through those opportunities.
Don't be afraid to be bold. Got it. No, I really am going to shut up.
No, good discussion.
Is that on the record?
Yes. For today.
So moving on, for 3 years, as you know, the U.S. still outperformed the rest of the world, primarily driven by the Magnificent Seven stocks for the last 3 years. So turning to our portfolio, so year to date, our total public portfolio returned 5.9%. Relative to a 5.2% for a 60-40 benchmark. That's not our official benchmark, but it's a good reference point. Looking at our public equity, as I mentioned, year to date as of Tuesday, we were at 9.6% versus 6.5% for our benchmark. So Boston Partners and WCM really stand out, outperforming their respective benchmarks significantly. They're doing exactly what we would expect them to do. But, you know, you can see there are some managers, you know, that have read numbers across multiple time periods. Of note, Waterscott, they're currently underperforming across multiple time periods. You know, as you know, Waterscott is a quality growth manager. They run a very concentrated portfolio, invest in high quality managers at reasonable price. So I think what has attributed to their underperformance is the trailing 12 months, where this market was not necessarily conducive for their investment style. If you look back, you know, last year around this time, they were actually in the top quartile, second quartile across multiple time periods. So I think staff still has conviction on Waterscott. We are they're on the performance fee schedule. We are paying very low fee on them, so we're going to continue to monitor them. Manulife is a value manager. Staff has a little bit more concern about them. Their performance of late has improved, but we've been concerned about their succession planning. Their investment team structure is somewhat of a star system where you know, the PM is like the star. So we're a little bit concerned about the key man risk, the succession planning. So as Ryan mentioned, we are planning to conduct a search in that space. And that's also going to be an opportunity for us to re-underwrite the manager. We're going to invite them to bid, and we're going to re-underwrite them. So, you know, so we're going to continue to like I said, monitor and potentially launch a search in the public equity space. Moving on to fixed income.
Can I ask a question on the post-charity space? We don't need to do this now. Well, the predicate question.
Yeah.
Are those returns post-fees or pre-fees?
They're net of fees.
Net of fees.
They're net. They're net of. We don't need to do this now, but I would look forward to a presentation from you guys comparing our performance in the public equity markets over the last couple of years to just index funds on a net fee basis. And let's just see how that compares. And I know we all have biases on these things, but I think the empirical data suggests that managed funds over time on a net-net basis just don't perform as well as index funds. And I'd love to see how we have done so we can make a collective informed assessment on that issue. And I know this comes up from time to time, but I would appreciate that opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, just a little bit of context. Like, historically, we build this portfolio of four global equity managers, two small cap, emerging market, and we ended up looking pretty close to the benchmark. Historically, we've outperformed by 50 bits net of fees across longer time periods, but we're doing a lot of stuff to get there. It's been value added for sure, but it ebbs and flows. And, you know, it's a tough space to outperform. And one other thing to note, just we have a good chunk of the portfolio at a passive mandate with, you know, the NT Acqui. That's a passive IMI. So all the returns we're showing here are kind of being brought back down or back up to the benchmark based on that allocation. But we do have an index fund in place.
And again, I don't want to prejudge it. I just think I would appreciate if we get the empirical data in front of us over the last 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, compare it to index funds. And let's just, I think we should periodically do a gut check on approach.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We'll look at that and try to get something scheduled.
Also, before we pull the trigger on, guys, let's see what the information ratios look like. We use that as a heuristic to make sure it's not just a sector problem versus a manager problem. I like the detail you went into with Manulife, where you're like, hey, that there is an operational consideration versus, wow, it's just a couple of down years, and in the fifth year, we're going to get mean reversion, and we're going to see a great pop. So,
yeah.
I mean, let's see the information ratios also.
Okay. Good point. And, yeah, like in Manulife, it's not a performance issue. It's, we have concerns kind of longer term on the viability of the team, so we want to be ahead of it.
So moving on to fixed income, as you can see year to date, we are 2.3%, slightly ahead of the blended benchmark. No concern over our fixed income managers. On the public credit side, we are slightly underperforming the blended benchmark. I think Makita is going to get into more details of the public credit manager. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of comments. You know, Pacific Bank Loan, they're underperforming a little bit, but their investment style is that they invest in larger, more liquid, higher quality bank loans. So, the portfolio, you know, I think they have a very low default rate across a very long period of time. So they're lagging a little bit, but we have no concern about them. And Loomis, we've talked to the board about their performance over the time, you know. They were hurt by some benchmark positions, but over the last 12 months or so, some of those positions kind of like worked out. So their recent performance it has been good. And we also lowered their fees quite a bit. So, but like I said, Makita is going to get into more details when they take a deep dive of our public credit managers. You know, we are also planning, as Ryan mentioned, this multi-sector credit search. So the idea is to take some proceeds from bank loan and high yield and fund the multi-sector credit manager down the road.
Our decision on allocation between debt and equity markets is informed by what? Is it informed solely by our investment thesis, or is it informed by a notion of what our obligations to beneficiaries is going to be over the short term, and then pressure test that to make sure that we can make those, given that we're only 30-plus percent funded? How do we think about that?
The big picture is driven by long-term asset allocation assumptions from Makita and us working through those and what asset classes make sense to build a portfolio that can return above 6.5% at a reasonable risk profile. In terms of the liquidity considerations, kind of medium term, that's why we have, you know, our fixed income position to be quite heavy in cash and short-term core bonds. We've talked about that safety reserve allocation, but that's 9% of the portfolio. We've talked about kind of do we need to keep that or not, depending on kind of what happens with the benefit payments coming in with additional contributions. But I kind of go back to it. I don't think we have any more core fixed income than anyone else. We just have a shorter duration profile. But I would say longer term, there's a little bit of tactical room in the rebalancing, but pretty much the asset allocation is updated every 3 years. Unless we see a need to come back in between, that would kind of broadly define how much in public equity, how much in credit, and how much in private.
Thanks.
Is there an argument, Kelly, for what's going to happen? Because again, I'll sort of say I'm not a big fan of I'm a big fan of trying to get a settlement just cash to start with. But if we can't get to that resolution, is there an argument for almost making a good bank tech bank scenario? So you just go, you know what, we're going to put this amount into fixed income, basically deal with our funding requirements, and then we're going to take the balance of the portfolio and structure it. Because at the end of the day, we need to be in an evergreen structure. I guess some of the things we were talking about earlier, we want to be in the space, we want to be dealing with the lawyers, we want to have the appropriate portfolio balance. And so maybe what you do is you just do what we did in the old days, put it in two components, and you go, this piece is designed to this piece is designed for satisfying our obligation. This piece is designed for an appropriate portfolio for what is.
It sounds like to some extent I heard you, Ryan, that to some extent we have done that, right, to the extent that we have skewed a bit towards cash within our fixed income portfolio. That's the logic, but in all other respects is driven without regard to our liquidity situation.
Yeah, and the amount in that reserve has gone down. When Makita came in 2018 and we updated the asset allocation and looked at the liquidity profile, we had a lot more in private and the cash flows out were higher. So we had 30 months of reserve in that cash and short-term bond bucket. We've lowered it to 18 months. And the actual outflows have been $6.3 million a month as opposed to 9.4. We actually have enough right now to cover 28 months. We haven't kind of split it out into two different portfolios, but I think having that reserve at a higher amount allowed us to be more aggressive in the rest of the portfolio, building out, you know, allocating more into public equities of what we could have liquidity to move into that portfolio.
Do we have a high degree of predictability on our outlook? Right?
Yeah,
yes.
So there's
very much.
Not much give and take on that.
Correct.
Okay. Who are we benchmarked against? Who are we benchmarked against?
We benchmark ourselves all sorts of ways. depends on who's doing it too. But largely, like our benchmark for the entire plan is that each asset class, you know, 58% in public equity times ACWI IMI, whatever in credit times the blended benchmark there. Makita, when they get into their report, will show what that is. We have a policy benchmark based on policy targets times ask plus benchmark, the allocation index, that's the current, or the allocation by quarter multiplied by the benchmarks, and then there's a peer comparison that we do in the McKee report that looks at, I don't know, Aaron, you could probably speak to what's in there better than I could.
Similar size, well, public pension plans between $1 and $5 billion.
Mm-hmm. So here's where I'll share with you on this topic that's a very complicated question. Here's why. So I liken it to like a marathon, right?
Right.
Everybody runs and you get the times and everybody comes in and you look backward, right? Not prospective, but you look backward. And maybe you look at our time, which has nothing to do with the people in this room.
Right.
And you say, wow, that was a really bad time. And you compare us to other people, and then you look back and you say, okay, well, why didn't they do better? You know, they should have done better, and what was the issue? And then you find out that we were running with one leg.
100%.
And then you compare us to other people, and there's no comp.
100%.
There's no comp 100%. That you can have
100%.
To compare that, right?
Tony, I'm saying something slightly different, which is you weren't running with one leg. You were running with 100 pounds on your back, right? And so what I'm saying is, you know what? What we do is we grab Tom and we go, Tom, you're going to carry that 100 pounds. Tony, you're going to run without the 100 pounds. So, Tom, I'm not going to benchmark you. There's nobody else running with 100 pounds on their back other than a couple of plants. Tony, you now actually don't have 100 pounds on your back. You're going to run a different race. We're going to compare you to a different bunch of guys because you're no longer running. So I get it. There's 100 pounds on your back.
And again, I've said this before, you know, risk means more things can happen than will happen. And it's harder to predict the future than it is the past. And so all we can do is look forward and try to do the best we can and believe in the team we have, the stuff we have. But the same, again, I'm just talking out loud, but how do we benchmark? That's a really complicated question.
It is. And what I probably should have said is who is our peer? Because what I would argue is there's almost two peers, right? There's one peer that I don't even know who you compare to, which is, you need to pay the requirements you have to pay, given that theoretically we can't solve this, we're in a line now. We can't think like that. You've got to just put that on the stop. So it's 18 or 20 months of funding. And then you go, okay, Ryan, new regime. Basically, we put money into an account to deal with the fact that we got a fund for the next 24 months. And you need to take the balance of the corpus of the fund, and you need to start thinking as if you're in this for the next 100 years, catch on. And I think that's going to give you some more policy flexibility. That's going to give you some better ability to tilt. That's going to open up some more issues. Because I will tell you, the private credit decision that was made that I voted on, approved, was a great temporizing measure. And then when I got home and thought about it, and I said, given what we're doing, private credit is a great way to cut the baby in half. But if I really went to you and said, Ryan, you got this money for the next 70 years, figure out what you would do, I bet your first choice wouldn't be private credit.
If that's true, then let's not look at 1 month, year-to-date, 1, 3, and 5 years. Let's start looking at 10, 15, 20.
Well, we want to make sure that actually people haven't driven off in the wrong direction to the airport. So that's why we're looking
at but if you know, there's tactical and strategic, and if the tactical or if the strategic decision short term,
100%. And what I'm suggesting is maybe we actually look at our portfolio allocation, our portfolio policy, and go, you know what? Until we can solve this, we got to break this baby into two pieces and go, I am not going to make Eric come back and try and fight a 74. I'm going to put the 100-pound pack over here. And we're going to deal with that. And you need to actually start thinking. Be as efficient as you can in managing that 100-pound pack, because we've got to pay our members. But let's start making investment and policy decisions that are reflective of the fact that we are an evergreen. We will be an evergreen. And let's not get distracted by the fact that we're in a knife fight at the moment to understand how we're going to get funded. Because at the end of the day, given what you're doing, Tag, what you're doing, Kelly, something's going to happen. Either we're going to reach a settlement, or we're going to fight for 5 years and get the money, but somehow we're going to get the money. So let's put some money in that and fund it. To fund our current obligations and protect obligations until we get a settlement or the fight's resolved, the rest of the portfolio and start acting like what we are, which is an everything institution. Give you the wherewithal to start thinking actually have a little venture in the fund. I should have some things that actually have less liquidity but higher return profile because I'm going to be here for the next 100 years, not because I got to have the ability to have get money into a fund, pay for something. I mean, so
I think what you're saying is what we've done in the portfolio with the safety reserve. We haven't quite looked at it that way, but I think what you're saying is think about how you allocate the rest of the portfolio. I'll say, you know, the risk posture of us and the IAC and the board has been, you know, when's the right time to reenter private markets and kind of dip our toe into the water? But like I said, I think we're taking care of these core allocations, credit, equity, and then we can be a bit more opportunistic around that.
You know, part and parcel with all this.
Hang on a second.
No, just part and parcel with all this. We've come a long way in trying to get the ship right. We're getting to the point now where I think we really need to sit down and put together a new asset allocation study going looking forward, look at the tactical bands that we're comfortable with and the amount of risk tolerance this board is comfortable with as we go through that process. And that would be the next step. And the IAC could help spearhead that and working with staff accordingly.
Because the reality is, you weren't here, cuts both ways. Which is, there's a lot of stuff where I'm saying where you weren't here for the face punch. You weren't here for the duplicity. And so, kind of, how dare you come in and say what you're going to say. You know, and then there's the other half of that, which is, you weren't here. And so, therefore, yeah, maybe we should think about it a little bit differently because we've been looking at it the same way.
Right. We've been looking in the past.
Yeah.
And we got Tony to pick up the 100 pounds.
No, actually, you got that backpack.
Tony's younger. So we weren't here for the face punch for the boxing match either. We came when everyone was bloody and the cleanup process. And so what you're suggesting is very close to what was decided with that concept of the safety reserve. We've got to carve off this.
Right.
Good bank, pay the bills, and then the rest we can invest. Adding venture, private equity, that was discussed for a number of years. The biggest issue was, for the longest time, the plan's been around $2 billion. But there was a lot of binary assets in there that we didn't know if this $100 million private equity fund was going to give 100 back or zero. And so as those big yes, no decision or outcomes were liquidated and the system got cash back, that has led us to this point now where we can jump back in and do some private equity, do some venture, do some private debt.
Maybe
because there was a huge unknown period where things could just go to zero.
Maybe this is for later and it's some you guys are reporting, but I'd love to hear, where do we stand? We have that bucket of bad stuff, right? And so where do we stand on rationalizing that? Obviously, we didn't do a fire sale, shouldn't do a fire sale. Where do we stand on that? And have we normalized, or do we still have some of those ragged edges that we're dealing with? And then if you do that, how do you normalize compared to benchmark? Is there a way to sort of pull those out so that we can actually evaluate our performance on an apples-to-apples basis?
Yeah. I'd say the 100-pound weight is 25 pounds now. So you made a lot of progress, but you're not clean. You're not healthy fully.
But if you look at the bottom of this page, we still have 20% in private markets right now. There's nothing. No,
you don't. That's my whole point. You don't. What you have is you have 25% in a bad bank.
Mm.
And in that bad bank, you got 25% to your point. And again, I'm not looking backwards. And if it sounds like I'm casting a
spell
on past behavior, I apologize for that because that's not what I wasn't here. What I'm saying is I'm looking at today. I'm looking at what we got. We got a crazy legal situation. We got a negotiation we're trying to have. We have members we have to pay. And we have a 32, 34% actuarially funded plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a city that can pay. So there's no doubt that the plan isn't going bankrupt. We're fighting over kind of the allocation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at it and you go, I got 25% in some bad assets. I've got cash to pay some benefit. And then I've got whatever's left. And whatever left is basically going to be the framework upon which I'm going to build the portfolio that we're going to do. So if I break those into two pieces and I go, well, 25% of our portfolio isn't allocated into private credit and some of that is not going to fit. No, let's look at what we know is clean. Let's look at how that should be allocated. Let's allocate that appropriately. And then understanding that we've got 25% of the fund in a bad bank and 10% of the fund in cash so we can take benefits. So it's 35% that you almost take off the table. And Rob, respectfully, what I would say is, I don't ever want to be in a conversation where you're trying to figure out what the portfolio allocation is going forward. And the first thing is we go, well, how are we going to pay for the 25% of stuff?
Couldn't agree more.
It's like, I want to go to law school, but I can't figure out how to pay for it. So I can't talk about law school until I figure out how to pay it. Yeah. And so, Ryan, part of the reason for being forceful is I want you to break the thinking to go, you know what? I got a job to do. I got a future in front of me. I got a plan that's evergreen. And I got 100 pounds that I just don't want to think about. Mm. Kelly's going to think about that. Kelly will figure out how to pay.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Kelly will figure out how to make the 25.
Well, maybe just to bridge the gap, because I think you guys are saying the same thing, just conversations I've had with Ryan. I think what you're saying is don't be afraid to be bold and be different. But I think Ryan will do that. Like, I think Ryan's thinking about that. He's just trying to work his way through
Currently it's a career management issue. What Tom is saying is it's incumbent on us on the board to basically change the asset allocation plan, change the portfolio allocation plan, so Ryan doesn't get out on a limb and they go, why didn't you think about the 25% that was never going to come back in private equity? Well, no, we as a board told him not to think about that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's on us to give him the latitude to embolden
to
people
yeah.
without putting a knife in his career.
And timing couldn't be better because of the environment that we're all living in anyway, as far as the geopolitical and inflation, stagflation, whatever you want to call it. So the timing is great.
Somebody's about to hand up an opportunity to make a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I agree with all the points. We'll look at it with the IAC and kind of take that contact into next time we look at the asset allocation, maybe accelerate that. But I do like where we're at on the private side where we have good allocation, and we have missed probably a few pretty bad vintage years, and we kind of build out the private portfolio with a fresh perspective and kind of look at the best opportunities.
We're with you.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
I think we can skip ahead. We talk through most of this different ways. The next item is a report on this IAC meeting from April 24th. We talked through these items last month, but we didn't talk about this item directly. We need to do it by policy. So just a quick update. We held a meeting on April 24th of the IAC. We updated the committee on the multi-asset credit search, reviewed the RFP. The IAC approved the search process document. We reviewed the private credit recommendations, going to the board for approval with KKR and Golub. And then we reviewed the private equity pacing plan, which outlines kind of pretty heavy amount to secondaries the first couple of years, and then commitments for the next 5 years. Anything, Tom, Michael, you guys want to add there?
We've covered it several times in the last couple of meetings.
So. Yeah. Okay, the next IAC item, go through. So this is a current list of, down the table at the bottom, the current IAC members and their terms. With some of the board turnover, we had some members, Nancy and Tina, who dropped off the board, who then also dropped off the investment advisory committee. Two outside members, Bob Jones and Luke Gittmeyer, stepped down from the committee as external members of the IAC. And just for the newer board members, by way of the statute, we need to have more external members on the committee than board members. So that's been a bit of an issue as we've gone through just from a quorum standpoint of not having more outside members at the meeting than board members. But I've talked to Tom over the last couple of months about kind of what do we do to kind of replenish the talent from the external members on the committee, and then what do we do with the board side of it with Nancy and Tina dropping off. So there are resumes at your seat, or profiles and resumes for two members that were recommended from committee members and came through Tom. I've spoken to both of them just to answer any questions about governance, understand their background, but I think they're two high-quality members we could add to the committee. How we typically do this, we don't want to talk about their names in open session, so if we want to go into close and have a discussion about them, we can, but if the board's comfortable with those two, we can vote to add them to the IAC. Tony, given his background in private equity, talked to Tom, I've talked to him. he's interested in joining from the board side to the IAC. And then the last piece of it, we've tried to make all these terms, they're two-year terms, and there's no term limit on the IAC. So most of these people have extended terms when their term comes up, but we try to make them stagger at alternating year end. So we would just like to, for convenience, and to make them more even, extend Tom's term and Ken Haven's term till the end of 2026.
26 or
25?
25.
26.
26. Because we can't go more than 2 years.
Ryan, that was my question. The term expiration dates, those are for the IAC or, like, for example, Tom 914, but that's not when you come on roll off this board, or is there a relationship between the two or help?
No, these are only IAC terms. Like, I believe Tom's board term ends in end of August 2026. So they're not related to the board term. If someone comes off the board, they're obviously off the committee. The board seat.
But somebody, if they come off this board, they can still remain on
correct.
The advisory board.
Correct.
As an outside member.
They would have they have changed status, but they can still stay on it for continuity purposes.
Correct.
As an outside member.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Ryan, I'm confused. I thought we were extending Tom's and Ken's to the end of 25. And you said 26. Am I wrong?
I think so. We talked about we can't go beyond 2 years, so we would extend them out to the end of 26 unless there's –
it's up to you, but
– I think that
– Then you only have two expiring in 25.
I'm not trying to make them even. I'm just trying to make them the longest term possible at a year end so we can –
Okay, that's fine.
Extend people once a year.
But like for me, I'll come off in August off this board.
Mm.
My term is – 26 on the IAC,
mm-hmm.
then I'll be converted to an outside
right.
board member.
But
there's not a space if the, if all those terms are, there wouldn't be a space.
No, there's not a limit. We could have a seventh outside member.
Okay.
And I always want to have more outside than inside because of the quorum and getting people there.
So make sure I understand that. So when Michael, his term on this board expires, end of August?
August.
End of August. But he can still remain on, and you could have additional spots for continuity purposes. You're good with that?
Yeah, so adding these two outside members would not prevent Michael from coming on in September. I think we'd have to do a separate board action to appoint him as an outside member, and we definitely want him in that role.
Well, that was my question, and I don't think we'd want to lose him by virtue of these two. So as long as we have the ability to stay in, that would be important for that purpose.
Yeah. No, we do, and then obviously if he comes off the board, we're down to two board members on the committee and mostly outside, but there's not a, as long as we have more outside than board members, that's what we need to do.
All right. Thank you.
Say a couple comments on the projects. Gene,
that's
right.
Okay. Yeah. As long as we're saying,
like,
I don't really want to have negative statements made.
Yeah. One of the recommendations is Gene Edels, and some of you may know him from his days at American Beacon, as well as Resolute Investment Managers. Bottom line, a lot of experience in the business, and he is also, the investment side really runs the gamut in terms of a lot of asset classes, and I think he'd be a great contribution to the IAC. He brings over 30 years of experience in the investment business. And the other gentleman is Ken Joji, and same kind of thing. He is also currently partner CIO of U Capital Advisors. He has also had a tremendous amount of experience in the business. He brings over 30 years as well in the investment frame. So a lot of expertise on both sides for the gentleman in terms of the private as well as the public side. And I think they'd both be great contributions to the IAC, and I'd recommend them accordingly.
Hey, Tom, University of Edinburgh is a very good business. And I noticed Ken's on the Puerto Rico. Is he on the investment committee? Because he's not good enough for his own family.
He's been around the block. Fair enough. That's it.
recommendation would be to have the board approve all three.
Yes, we need a motion to appoint Gene Needle, Ken Shoji, and Tony Scazuzzo to the IAC.
I should probably abstain from that, right?
Well, screw that. I could have used your extension earlier.
Yeah.
maybe it doesn't matter, John.
I don't think it matters.
Right. Michael, just so we don't have to do two motions, if we could add, extend the terms of Ken and Tom.
Okay. So, I need a motion to appoint Gene Needles, Ken Shoji, Tony Scavuzzo to the IAC, and extend the terms of Tom Toll and Ken Haven to 12/31 of 2026.
So moved.
I got a second.
Second.
All right. All in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Say nay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. And now we move to the first quarter of 2025 investment performance analysis. Aaron and Colin.
Thank you. Great to see everyone again. David, pleasure to meet you. I like to speak in analogies when talking to boards, so impressed you were able to weave three different steak analogies in the course of about 5 minutes earlier.
we call that a hyper extended metaphor, but.
And Rob, welcome back. We shared time at the same table back in your first term. So and I'm here with Colin Kowalski, who's out of our San Diego office. Being respectful of time, I'm going to try to keep this high level and focus on a couple of charts that maybe answer some of the questions and discussion we had earlier. So if you are following along in front of you, I'm going to bounce around, so apologies. But I'm going pretty much to the end here. I'm going to cover the kind of the quarterly report, and then Colin is going to dive into that credit asset class review that Christina mentioned. So here we have five-year chart showing the asset allocation history of the system. And if you think about the good bank, bad bank analogy and the assets that were kind of either ring-fenced or potentially ring-fenced, the purple, real assets, there was frankly a lot of unknowns and junk in there, as well as the green private equity. So if you look back 5 years, you can see on that left vertical axis how much exposure that was and how both have shrunk and been liquidated over the last 5 years. And that money, by and large, outside of paying, you know, significant benefits, has gone right into the blue public equity stock market. You think back in 2020, this system had a very low, below average exposure there. It was about, I was probably in the mid-20s. And frankly, with the benefit of hindsight, that was exactly the right move, because the last 5 years, it's all been about being in the stock market, particularly the U.S. stock market. So significant progress from that perspective, but not immediate. It has taken a long time to exit many of the, you know, questionable investments that occurred mostly in that 2006 to 2010 range. Now going backwards.
But on, Aaron, on that, so you're saying that the quote unquote bad bank assets are confined to those two tranches, number one. But within those two tranches, how much of each tranche would be in a bad bank?
I mean, so I'll answer that and let Aaron chime in. When they came on board in early 18, we had probably 60% in private.
Right.
That was post the secondary sale we did. So we sold the good private equity we had.
Okay.
So I would say most of it was, there was a few good assets that turned out well, but most of it, 85% was in the bad bank. At that time, if we took this chart back to 2016, at one point in 16 or early 17, we had less than 10% of public equity. So there was all this over here, and then just by way of a very risky bad bank, we built out the fixed income safety reserve first, and then started adding to the public equity portfolio as we could sell assets from the
part of the portfolio.
But still, so maybe I'm missing something, but within real estate and private equity today, how much of those respective categories would properly characterize in a bad bank category as opposed to part of a just normalized investment portfolio?
90%
in the past?
Yeah, what we have left, there's three big assets, and I would call them bad, especially in the real estate side, but difficult to sell. Good assets, difficult to sell on the real estate side.
But they have
big,
value.
What?
But they have value.
Yeah, they have, you know, it's not the binary. We don't know what's going to happen. They have value. Just when should we exit them? But the vast majority of what we have is in those three, Huff Energy, the Lone Star private equity, and the A&M real estate portfolio.
And the Huff is really the swing.
Yeah, Huff Energy, I mean, if that, it's an energy 2006 vintage fund that has a lot of acreage and proven undeveloped reserves that they can sell. And that's more of the binary. We don't know what's going to happen or when it's going to sell. And the valuation is very volatile and tied to energy prices. So we made a decision last fall to move that into its own category, which actually freed up some additional room in the allocation to make new private equity investments. Does that answer, Rob?
It does. That in the Hunt Energy piece at some point, maybe you could tell us what that's about. And it was a general investment.
Yeah, it's Hoff Energy, not Hunt.
Oh, I see. So that's the Hoff piece you're talking
about. Yeah, basically that's where you can see the pink, where we split that out from the private equity-free portfolio last fall.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Brian, do we put out RFPs for managers?
On the public side, we do.
When was the last time we put out an RFP on the private or alternative side, or for a secondary?
We haven't done an RFP on that side in my time here, which goes back to 2012. It's typically been working with the consultant, identifying best opportunities, doing a kind of internal search of best opportunities on the private side and selecting a manager. Obviously, we had a big break there of not doing it. So traditionally, we haven't issued RFPs on the private side. Obviously, it depends on kind of who's in the market. It's a highly rated fund, so it's a little bit more difficult, I would say, to do a formal RFP there, as opposed to what we do on the public side when we do issue on this multi-asset credit. We just issued RFP requests to 11 firms.
Yeah, I just wonder if you might want to make an announcement. Mm-hmm.
Something to think about, for sure. There was a little bit of press around the new private credit. We've been telling the story, so.
Yeah, but to be fair, back to 2012, how many private managers have we been in allocation?
Three.
Right. But not a bad point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we've been looking. We worked with Allbirn for a couple of years, hired them 2 years ago. We've been talking with managers and talking with the board about, you know, like the last 4 years, it's been, when is this day coming? We're going to start reinvesting in private markets. What do we need to put in place to get there? Policy, asset allocation, IAC, subcommittee, the IAC, what's the approval process? So it's not like we're just stepping back in right now. We've been figuring out what we want to do and looking at opportunities and figuring out where to go over the last couple of years.
Just for the record, too, it probably wouldn't hurt when we get to that point to do or at least consider an RFP for a private side. You pick up a lot of information and education that way, which can help you in the overall investment process as well as, you know, doing the deal itself. So, I thought.
And we did do an RFP when we hired Allbirn as a private market consultant to several other private market specialty groups and kind of talked about the different investment models, what they could bring to the table. We went through that process to hire Allbirn.
So here's the deal. Mm-hmm. Fix the bar. You're driving it like you drive it safety. I want you to drive it like you failed. Fix it. Mm-hmm. It works. Run. You've done the hard. We'll get you the asset allocation.
Yeah.
We'll get you the investment policy statement that gets you the coverage.
Mm-hmm.
But it's time to start thinking about, not that you're a fund in recovery,
No, I understand your point. We have everything kind of in place. Going back to the IAC, I think our best resource is the quality of that committee, you know, compared to other $2 billion pension plans. You don't see that type of talent to help out, build out the portfolio.
Yeah, and Ryan, again, like I'm saying, just looking at the board, we have to do our part, which is, as Tom made the point, you know, we need to actually revisit the asset allocation. We need to revisit the investment policy statement so that you know you're basically working with a mandate, because I think it's time to give you the mandate.
Okay.
You guys wasn't here for, but you guys have done the hard work to prepare. You know, don't know how it's going to happen, but there's more capital.
Appreciate that.
No 3-wood off the tee, Ryan. Driver only.
You saw me with driver a couple months ago.
So that was a 5-year look back. Now this is a 1-year look back. And to state the obvious, I'm seeing more green than red on this page. I will hit the highlights. If you look at can't remember who asked about benchmarking, but there's a number of ways we benchmark. And so, okay, to Rob's point. Over this 1 year, you'll see two places where you underperformed. And so I'm going to skip those, hit the others, and I'll end on those underperformed. We look at, halfway through the page, your public active managers and how well they've done relative to each respective passive index that you could have gone into. And so over this period, 7 out of 13 beat their individual benchmarks. Then we look at the next two lines, the next line is a way of trying to figure out how well the healthy part of the portfolio did relative to kind of the baseline public market universe. And this was something the board requested many years ago because of that concept of we got the weight on our back. There's only so much we can do, but this part we can control, let's see how well we're doing there. So we always look at just the stock and bond managers relative to a 60-40. So over this 1 year, we have outperformed kind of the broad 60-40 benchmark. Then we look at it, well, what if that was your whole portfolio relative to peer pension plans? Because this is our healthy part, and it's the assumption that other pension plans are fully healthy. That could be wrong. It could be, yeah. So you can see over this period, if you just had the stock and bond strategies, again, you would have outperformed the median U.S. public pension plan between $1 and $5 billion. And then that concept of the safety reserve, that is paying the bills. So we always want to make sure that we're targeting around 9% of the portfolio. What is the actual dollar, Ryan? 180?
Yeah, 180.
$180 million. To pay the bills. That's our good bank slush fund. And so we're good there. You go to the top, there's two areas you underperformed. The total pension system underperformed its policy index. So the policy index is, Ryan was explaining it earlier, essentially the weight of each asset class multiplied by the subcomponent policy benchmark. And so what you see here is very typical of every pension plan this last year is because you have assets like private equity, other private debt or private real estate assets that are marked to market very infrequently, and you have a policy benchmark that is public, basically the stock market type movement. So in a year when the public stock market and public indices are up a lot, just because the stock market's up 25% doesn't mean your house goes up 25%. So seeing that underperformance is very typical of every other plan in the...
Then why is that a relevant comparison? Why make it at all? It just feels like apples to oranges.
That's the best the industry's got, essentially. Otherwise, there is no way to assess how we're doing. If you, other than looking at, did you beat your... actuarial target return. It's imperfect. We recognize that. The industry does. And it's better over multi-years when that noise washes out.
I mean, obviously, it's much more relevant if you're closer to your targets and you actually have, you know, the right types of assets in the private equity and the, you know, private portfolio.
And then peers is always a lightning rod topic because, frankly, it doesn't matter. To the marathon analogy, that's great. Like, you know, Colin may run a three-hour marathon and I run a four-hour. He might be mad and I might be thrilled. Because we're totally independent about like what our objectives are. We're all humans, and we love to see how well we're doing relative to our neighbors. So we do look at peers. We don't try to make decisions based off of it, but we do use it as a barometer. So you underperformed in this 1 year. The biggest factor there is the U.S. equity exposure versus non-U.S. So this is 12 months, three quarters from 2024 and one from 2025. This plan has had an overweight to European equities relative to the benchmark. That has helped tremendously the last 3 to 5 months, but it hurt in the 2024 period. So that's why we believe you have you underperform peers over this period.
That's the principal driver on the underperformance?
Versus peers. You know, no one's private equity did that well during that period. So the DPSP private equity kind of, the effect of that was more muted. Any questions?
So essentially, if I read what you're saying and understand it properly, are underperformance or overperformance relative to peers is a lot due to asset allocation versus manager selection. Is that correct?
Not entirely, because you're using global managers that have the discretion to move the regional. So in a way, if you picked four managers that were all heavy on U.S., this is a more of a manager selection issue in this case. Because you were in the stock market, so that would be the asset allocation.
Because they're making the allocations European versus
U.S. Correct, yeah.
And that gets to the point of why we need to revisit the asset allocation and the investment policy statement. Right. So given the strength of our team, do we want to make targeted selections so that I hired you to be the best manager to pick U.S. large versus I hired you to basically pick the best market around the globe? I'll figure that out. And again, that's a function of if you got $6, give it to somebody who can go anywhere. If you got $6 billion, then you know what? I'm going to give $100 million to this guy, $100 million to that guy, and I'll crack it.
So it's a good discussion and one that this board has been having for 10 years, global versus using regional targets, and we've looked at it many times. The four global managers generally have done a good job of zigging and zagging and always having playing in their position the way we want them to, and the results have, we'll do another a public equity analysis deep dive at some point in the next couple of months. You can hopefully the results will show that.
Back tested that against just.
Yeah. So that's what that analysis is always doing.
And what's performance been kind of 3 and 5?
Generally outperforming by 10 to 50 basis points with a little less volatility. It depends, you know, when you start and end it. But the last time we did the analysis, it was show that it's worked.
This, at this end date, like 3 years, we're outperforming by 30 bits.
Against an ETF. Equivalent portfolio.
Yeah, it gets a passive 20 bips on the 10-year, 20 bips on the inception. So like I said, it's very close. I would expect the next endpoint to be better given that international.
But that's net, not gross, right?
That's net.
Yeah, we never show gross.
But like I said, you kind of look at it, every time we look at it, we do a lot of work to put together this portfolio that it has outperformed, but it's like just outperformed. It tracks the index fairly closely. So I think it's a fair question, what the right approach would be. We had no passive in 2018, and with the target 25% of the public equity, 40% of the public equity portfolio.
25%
of 85. Yeah, so basically the target passive is a good chunk of the public equity allocation.
So it leads me to the conclusion that the machinery is working right. Our tactical skills are good. The question is it time to rethink the strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always fair to ask if what we're doing there makes sense given all the
changing conditions.
Yeah.
Good.
And we've been talking to Keith about kind of small cap, and that's been a drag because we have a bit higher exposure to small cap in our portfolio. So I think there's multiple aspects to look at. We'll do that and report back to that. IAC and then kind of get their findings and bring that to support.
Yeah, my overarching just opinion of the health of the pension is that you have a lot of the right machinery in place to go forward. But if you look backwards, there's so many weights on the back and cancers and broken legs that, like, there's no way you can ever make it look pretty going backwards. And by the time you get it to a good place, then you have to wait and be patient for the couple of years to occur to then see the fruits of your labor.
If we looked backwards, we'd be terrified. And some people.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we all look backwards, and this whole presentation is looking backwards. I'm going to end and then pass it to Colin in the spirit of time. This is another way of looking at the success of the machinery. These are all the public markets managers. And to, I guess, what Rob was trying to point out earlier is, well, how do they look relative to passive? So if it says yes and it's in green, it's good. If it says no and it's in red, passive would have been better. You're never going to see all green on here. Just, it's an unrealistic expectation. You guys know that. But if I look at, say, the three-year column, it's a pretty good hit rate of greens to no's. And if I look at the five-year, I see a lot of NAs. All those NAs are places that this board or investment advisory committee did an RFP, replaced the machinery, and found a better tool to use. And so, again, that's looking forward, we have confidence in them. Looking backwards, you don't have any, you know, analysis here. But generally, most pensions, if I look at any column, they're just trying to have 50 to 60% green relative to the red. I didn't do the exact math here, but I think probably a bit higher than that if you count up all the greens versus reds. Okay. Questions before I pass it over to Colin? And we'll try to pick up the pace.
Sounds good. Thanks, Aaron. I'm going to hop through a review of the public credit component, hopefully add a little bit more color to what both Christina and Aaron have talked about a little bit earlier today. So the first page that I'm going to go through is a brief history of the public credit component here. The first manager that was hired in 2016 was Aristotle Pacific Bank Loans, previously just Pacific, it's now Aristotle Pacific. So that was hired to fulfill the bank loan allocation within this component. Also in 2017, Ashmore Emerging Market Blended Debt was hired to fulfill the emerging market debt allocation. Makita came on in 2018 and did a review of this program. We evaluated it as part of our initial fund review and kept those two managers in place. In 2021, the current Loomis High Yield product that you see in the performance reports was hired. There was previously an older Loomis team that comes into the track record, but was no longer the go-forward manager in 2021. 2022, the Ashmore Emerging Market Blended Debt product was terminated and replaced with the MetLife Emerging Market Manager, which you see now in the performance reports. That was done in 2022. And then most recently in 2025, the current structure that you see was approved earlier this year. And so I'll go through what that looks like next. Here you can see what the current targets are for this component. So in total, public credit is 11% target for the total plan. 2% of that towards a dedicated bank loans manager, 2% of that to a dedicated high yield manager, 3% of that to emerging markets debt, and then a new allocation, 4% to multi-asset credit. There's currently an RFP underway for that. And so that this is the structure that was approved in 2025 earlier this year, and it is what is reflected in our performance reports. This table just shows a little bit more color on that. Basically where things stand as of now. And I'll go ahead and move to the next page here. This shows a little bit a little bit more detail on each of the existing managers. Currently, the bank loans component is at 4%. That will be reduced down to 2% once that multi-asset credit manager is funded. That one has a low duration. It's a bank loan strategy, floating rate bank loans, so the duration exposure is fairly low with a strong yield of maturity close to 8%. The high yield manager is Loomis High Yield. Again, that's at 4%. That will go down to 2% once multi-asset credit is funded. It has a moderate duration profile, about 3 years, and a strong yield of maturity around 7. And then finally, the emerging market debt that's managed by MetLife. That's at 3% now, which was recently reduced down from 4% previously. Duration is a little bit higher at 5 years, but a really strong yield of maturity at 9% there. Across the board, the duration profile is pretty moderate, around 2.5 years, and the total yield of maturity on this entire component is about 8%. In terms of liquidity, two of these are monthly liquid, and then the Lumi strategy is daily liquid, so no major tie-ups there in terms of liquidity. The next page shows the aggregate sector distribution of these three components together versus the benchmark. You can see across the table here, the green is the total exposure of the composite versus the pink, which is the blended credit benchmark. Pretty close to target across the board here. Majority of the exposure being in that corporate bucket, followed by bank loans, and then you see the foreign and foreign local components that exist within the emerging markets allocation, but close posture-wise to the benchmark across the board. From a credit quality distribution perspective, it's very similar. You can see the composite versus the benchmark across the stack here, fairly close to the benchmark across the board, most of the exposure being within that BB and single B range. Minor difference being that the credit composite within the plan, its average quality is B, whereas the benchmark is closer to BB, but across the board, very similar to its benchmark across the stack. Performance-wise, you can see the trailing performance here through 3/31. Christina went through it earlier today, more recently through the end of May. But the performance over the short-term period, so the quarter-day and one-year period, slightly trailing the blended benchmark, but very close, trailing that benchmark over the 3 and 5 years a little bit more. So recent performance has been good, although slightly trailing. And if you look through the end of May, it's actually been outperforming for the quarter-to-date or for the one-year period. Longer-term performance has struggled, and that has to do with some of those legacy positions within Ashmore and the old Loomis team. But for the most part, performance is where we would expect. And I'll talk about the individual strategies next. So here the first strategy is Loomis High Yield. This is a dedicated high yield manager. Performance over the short-term period looks good. It's outperforming for the quarter-to-date and one-year periods, but underperforming over the 3 years since inception. This is one that we've paid particular attention to in recent years. It actually had underperformed over trailing periods through mid last year. A lot of that has to do with some of its off-benchmark positions within emerging markets that really hadn't paid off. So this is one that we had looked at very closely over the past year. A lot of that has paid off and performance has started to turn around. So one we've continued to monitor over those longer-term periods but has done better in the past year. So that's something, a positive sign that we see with this manager. Next is Aristotle Pacific. This has been around since 2017. It's been a strong performer for the plan. This invests in bank loans, typically larger loans that have lower default rates, and because of that, it's done better in down markets. Performance here looks mixed over the short-term periods, but really strong over the 3 year and since inception periods. And in periods where we see down markets, it's done really well. If you look at the second table there, there's a down capture component, which is 83%, and so that shows that when the market's down 100%, this one's only down 83%, and so that down market capture has served this strategy really well, and it's one that's done well over most trailing periods.
On the inception, it's kind of a funky benchmark, but you can see we're outperforming by 25% of fees. That manager is in the top 10% of their peer group, but it's a bit of a kind of benchmark issue and kind of what's in that universe, but they're performing well amongst the rest of the bank loan managers.
Yeah, absolutely. Then the last manager is MetLife. Again, this was hired in 2022. performance over the quarter to date in a one-year period has trailed its benchmark. It's been more mixed there, but it looks really strong since 2022, 11.2% versus its benchmark of 9.8%, and it ranks in the top median compared to other similar managers. This manager invests in emerging markets across the three main components, so sovereigns in U.S. dollars, sovereigns in local terms, and then corporate within U.S. dollars. It's a bottom-up manager. Security selection is bottom-up, but it does rotate across those markets and can add alpha that way. It's done so since 2022. So this is one that, you know, it's more of a recent hire, but it's done well so far and really filled that component.
Are we comfortable that they're invested only in emerging markets and not frontier?
Yeah.
Okay.
That wraps up my prepared remarks. We'd be happy to take questions on anything within this report.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Move on to the legislative update.
What about the private
market? Oh, the private market report. Okay.
Oh,
it'll be very brief. Click here. Okay, so this report now comes from Allborn. It used to come from Akita. This will be more relevant as some of the new investments come into the portfolio. I was just going to point out a few points of info for you guys. So on 112 of Diligent, you can see kind of the current quarter, the NAVs at the end of Q4, $413 million. This does not include marks on Huff and Lone Star. Everything else is Q4 marks except those two. Brendan mentioned we should expect to have those in the next by the end of the month. This just shows the commitments by year. At the top left, you can see the kind of the binge of investments from 2016 prior. But this will include all of our historical investments. What we plan to do with Allborn is have separate composites for each of the new asset classes as we add new investments to the portfolio. But I think these charts are good, just showing kind of what's changed in the last 12 months on the right hand side of the page, what changed last quarter. As you go through here, you can see detailed info on each of the funds, what the performance has been, marked by quartile and how the performance has ranked to their vintage year peer group. Like I said, this will become more relevant. A lot of data in here as we add new investments to the portfolio. Any questions on the private markets? All right.
Hey, Ryan, when you go back into the market, do you think you'll narrow the number of managers you have?
I'd like to. I think the way I think about it, I'm not overly concerned about being super diversified in our 10% portfolio. I'd rather have, you know, higher conviction commitments.
I think that also gives you better standing to get co-invest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll need to talk about that. It's tough at our size, but I think there's some opportunities there as well.
Thank you.
All right, legislative update.
Thank you, Ryan. So the session ended.
Not yet.
And obviously, the headline is that SB 1527 did not get a hearing in committee. Thanks, guys. And so no action was taken. That was the board's direction, that was the board's hope, and so I hope that the board's pleased with that. The only other thing out of the legislative session that I think we had previously reported on, it ended up not passing, was a line of duty death bill that would have paid $1 million lump sum upon a death. It was proposed by, I don't remember the senator that proposed it, but the representative, but the it was pushed by the Austin Police Plan because they don't have an enhanced death benefit, and so they were seeking one. And the bill initially was
was proposed to be just related to them, but it got broadened to all systems, and then it got it did not pass. And I think the idea is that most systems, including ours, which we got a couple of sessions ago, have an enhanced death benefit for people who die in the line of duty. So, obviously a very active session, but not a lot to report that will ultimately affect us going forward coming out of that.
Good question. Do we know, and these things go through an evolution anyway, do we know if the Senator West legislation ever got out of committee?
It never went to committee.
Okay, didn't.
Didn't sponsor, got a sponsor for 3 hours, because, I mean, quite often the city lied to a person. Said we were behind it, the person picked it up, and then when rep was reminded where we stood by various people, including Hillco, they resolved that. So,
okay,
yeah,
good.
And
good
that
stuff.
Officially got sponsored and brought to pay.
Okay, thanks.
Am I missing anything else?
No.
Nope.
You want to go on the legal?
Yeah.
Okay. So now we'll go to close session.